And even though everyone agreed the war would not end in a purely military outcome, State was never able to make a detailed presentation to the full NSC on the civilian political process or the possibility of a political solution to the war. He had been deprived of a chance to persuade the president personally, despite the enormous stakes in the war. Unlike the military, the civilians never had a meeting alone with the president, with the important exception of your weekly private meeting with the president, which I attended once. Petraeus was selling tempered optimism, he continued, but I have my doubts. There is a fundamental flaw in our strategy, the mismatch between our stated objectives and the time and resources allocated to achieve them. At this point, he continued, the best that can be hoped for is a bloody stalemate. Moreover, as far as I can tell, one constant about counterinsurgency, it does not work against an enemy with a safe sanctuary. And I do not believe we can get Pakistan to see its strategic interests as being symmetrical with ours. He had been working on these problems since he took office. It sounded as if he was giving up. On Thursday, December 9th, Holbrook lunched with one journalist, Susan Glasser, the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, and dined with a second, Michael Abramowitz, a longtime Washington Post reporter and editor who had recently taken up a senior position at the Holocaust Museum. Holbrook met Abramowitz at 1789, an expensive Georgetown restaurant. Holbrook complained that while in government service, his expenses were outrunning his income by hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They talked for 2.5 hours about family and journalism. Holbrook lamented the passing of fact-based reporters and the rise of bloggers who trafficked in drivel. The next morning at 7:30 a.m., Holbrook called Ruggiero to prepare for a briefing later that morning with Hillary Clinton. The White House had scheduled a principals committee meeting for Saturday, December 11th, to review drafted assessments by the National Security Staff that assessed how the Afghan war was going a year after Obama's West Point speech. Holbrook arrived late on State's seventh floor and found Clinton with her aides, including Jake Sullivan. He joined the discussion, but suddenly turned very red. "Richard, what is the matter?" Clinton asked. "Something horrible is happening," he answered. Clinton told him to seek treatment from State's medical unit at once. Soon Holbrook lay prone in an ambulance racing to George Washington University Hospital. Doctors found a tear in his aorta. They operated for 21 hours, but did not emerge optimistic. Clinton attended the principal's meeting on Saturday with Ruggiero to discuss the Munich meeting with Tayyip Aga. Everyone was in casual weekend clothes. Clinton and Defense Secretary Robert Gates were in a pitched battle with Doug Luton, his national security staff, over the staff's judgments about progress, or the lack of it, in Afghanistan. Gates argued that the NSC's paper understated military gains on the Afghan battlefield. Clinton argued that State's diplomatic and civilian efforts in Afghanistan were going better than the NSC paper described. The pair was furious at Lute's pessimism about the war, in Gates's characterization. Gates argued that Lute appeared to question the strategy itself rather than identify how to make it work better. Yet to Lute and his staff, the facts were stubborn. The war was not going well. Why shoot the messenger? Since the late 2009 West Point speech, the ISAF command had expanded the number of key terrain districts to 96, effectively enlarging the size of the battlefield NATO was supposed to subdue. Lute and others at the White House were digging in against any effort by Petraeus and Gates to prolong a counterinsurgency war that they believed was not sustainable. Lute's position, backed by his NSC staff, was that the color-coded metrics on the CIA's district assessment maps of Afghanistan, updated late in 2010, had not changed much. The hard data described a stalemate that might slightly favor the United States, although it wasn't clear for how long. The most recent national intelligence estimate, a product of the entire intelligence community, was pessimistic. Petraeus, Gates, and Clinton might feel progress being made, but where was the objective evidence? Moreover, Lute argued, whatever territorial gains might be made in Kandahar and Helmand, on what basis did anyone think the gains would be held once American forces departed? The December review's outcome, after so much contention, was incoherent. The review ratified, but did not prioritize, five American lines of effort in Afghanistan. One was to continue to degrade the Taliban militarily and build Afghan capacity to fight the war. The second was to execute a transition to place Afghan forces in the lead combat role. A third was to negotiate a long-term strategic and security agreement with Afghanistan that might allow some American forces to stay behind after 2014. The fourth was to try to stabilize Afghanistan through regional diplomacy. And the fifth was to pursue political reconciliation with the Taliban through direct talks. These lines of policy were not integrated into a single plan. Petraeus could fight his hard war of night raids as aggressively as he saw fit, and the State Department could try to negotiate a peace deal through Tayyip Aga, but there would be no effort to unify those strategies. Petraeus rejected Holbrooke's premise that there was a deal worth pursuing with Tayyip Aga. Holbrooke rejected Petraeus's premise that counterinsurgency doctrine could succeed. Holbrooke died in the hospital on the evening of Monday, December 13th. 3 days later, Obama appeared with Gates and Clinton in the White House briefing room to present summary findings of the president's latest Afghan war review. Obama acknowledged Holbrooke, whose memory we honor and whose work we'll continue. Obama delivered the positive spin about Afghanistan promoted in the Situation Room by Petraeus, Gates, and Clinton. This continues to be a very difficult endeavor, the president admitted, yet we are on track to achieve our goals. He detected considerable gains toward our military objectives on the ground in Afghanistan, although the progress was fragile and reversible. As for Pakistan, Obama was pleased that its government increasingly recognizes that terrorist networks in its border regions are a threat to all our countries, and he hoped to deepen trust and cooperation. All in all, it was an assessment that might have been delivered, and sometimes was, in 2006 or 2007. Whatever Obama's private doubts about the Afghan war he had escalated, in public at least, he was willing to speak optimistically. It was a practice soon to expire. The gossamer illusions of American partnership with Pakistan and with Hamid Karzai would be exposed in the coming year as never before. Chapter 28. Hostages. By late 2010, the estrangement between the CIA and ISI had become so deep that officers on both sides resorted to dismal metaphors to describe its descent. The liaison was like a bitter marriage that neither party had the will to break. It was like a fingernail on a dead man's hand that kept growing when all other life had ceased. The more the CIA and the Pentagon worked with Ahmed Pasha, and the more they eavesdropped on his conversations, the less they thought of his capabilities. Pasha texted Ruggiero and others on open cell phones. Ruggiero gave him a code name, The Shoe. He was more emotional and sensitive than ever. The new American ambassador to Islamabad was Cameron Munter, a Ph.D. historian and career foreign service officer who had previously served in Iraq. As he settled into the embassy, he took a more sympathetic view of the ISI chief. He saw Pasha's outlook as the product of genuine feelings of betrayal. The ISI chief had taken considerable professional risks to forge a closer relationship with the CIA, including putting up with unilateral drone operations that killed Pakistani citizens. Yet, despite such cooperation, Pasha had often been treated as an incorrigible enemy. They had to deal with him as he was, a strong nationalist who might be cooperative from time to time. For holding these views, Munter was accused by CIA counterparts of being soft on Pakistan. For his part, although he maintained and valued personal friendships with American counterparts in Islamabad, he had more than wearied of the pressure and stubbornness of official visitors. One after another, they arrived at ISI headquarters or Army House with their diplomatic demarches, their complaints, and their requests for more visas, more military offensives against Pakistani citizens, more access to Taliban prisoners. They constituted a diverse bureaucratic parade. Ambassadors, special envoys, deputy secretaries, deputy assistant secretaries, generals, CIA directors, CIA deputy directors, ISAF commanders, central command generals. Pasha and Kayani found these formalized meetings repetitive at best, offensive at worst, and overall, less and less useful. They felt that most of their American visitors understood Pakistan and Afghanistan poorly. Yet the Americans' cloak of global power made them hubristic, rarely inclined to listen sincerely to local knowledge. Around this time, U.S. intelligence distributed to Allied spy services a memo laying out the Pakistani spy service's day-to-day priorities, based on U.S. collection of intelligence about ISI. The document offered a snapshot of what ISI really cared about. The service's number one priority was collecting information about Pakistani President Asif Zardari, his scheduled meetings, his conversations, his political activities. A second priority involved suppressing the Pakistani Taliban. A third was to monitor and assess a medley of militant groups active against India, including indigenous Maoists operating in poor areas of India's interior. The list of priorities did not include Al-Qaeda or the Afghan Taliban, the enemies that animated the Obama administration. The United States might still have a few overlapping interests with the Pakistan Army, but not many. In mid-November 2010, American relatives of victims of the Mumbai terrorist attack named Pasha as a defendant in a lawsuit seeking compensation for the family's losses. Pasha blew up in private about the suit. The Americans tried to assure him that he would not be subject to arrest when he next traveled to the United States. This was a civil case in a court outside the control of the Obama administration, they explained. Pasha didn't buy it. If you really thought of me as a friend, this wouldn't happen, he said. Pasha's young adult children warned him to be careful about traveling to the United States ever again. This looked like a trick, one that could end with his arrest. The Pentagon and the CIA assured Pasha he would not be bothered when he next flew to Washington to attend Richard Holbrooke's memorial service, where Pasha felt a personal need to be present. Yet he remained on guard. A month later, an Islamabad human rights lawyer, Shahzad Akbar, who had previously worked on army-backed investigations into Bhutto family corruption, filed a lawsuit against the United States on behalf of victims of CIA drone attacks. The court papers named as a defendant the CIA's Jonathan Bank, breaking Bank's cover as station chief. Akbar insisted he had obtained the name through local journalists and had developed his case without any contact from ISI. The CIA doubted that. This was Pasha's revenge for the Mumbai lawsuit, some at the agency concluded. Pasha pleaded innocence. The CIA station chief in Islamabad was as much diplomat as spy and enjoyed hardly any cover. In any event, Bank received death threats. Akbar's car and office were mysteriously trashed. CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell flew to Pakistan. At the end of his scheduled visit, Bank followed his boss onto his unmarked jet and departed the country, without telling Pasha he was pulling out. The bad voodoo spread to street-level operations. By the end of 2010, there were 285 American military personnel in the country. More than half were special operations forces. They were notionally on a training mission, but they had effectively created a forward operating base that neither Kayani nor Pasha could monitor or control. The goal in some sections of the Pentagon was to eventually persuade the Pakistanis to grant the United States Title X authority, a reference to the section of federal law that governs American armed forces. This authority would allow the U.S. military to operate on Pakistani soil as it did in Afghanistan, which would be unprecedented in Pakistani history. There were also dozens of CIA case officers, temporary duty officers, and security personnel in Pakistan. The CIA and Pentagon personnel often applied for visas as diplomats, but then arrived at Islamabad International in cargo pants and T-shirts, inked with tattoos. "Do you think we're stupid?" a Pakistani official asked a State Department intelligence analyst over lunch one day during this period. "Do you think we think those 300 visas are for first and second secretaries?" American intelligence officers and diplomats with long experience in Pakistan were appalled by the rough arrogance of contractors and street surveillance specialists rotating through. The old hands were used to floating around Pakistan on their own, but now, whenever they wanted to visit carpet shops or bookstores, even in placid Islamabad shopping centers, they had to bring along personal security detail officers to keep them safe. Children would run up to shine the American shoes or beg for a few rupees, and the contractors would shove the kids out of the way. Conduct no American diplomat would have countenanced a decade before. The contractors drove around aggressively in SUVs, talking on their Motorola radios as if they were deep in enemy territory, sideswiping or threatening Pakistani drivers who bothered them, calling them monkeys or niggers, and getting spun up about any offense. The contractors and TDY types didn't know anything about Pakistan or care. For the few Obama administration Urdu conversant hands who had known the country before September 11th and were supposed to be fashioning a durable relationship in difficult circumstances, it all seemed embarrassing and ugly. The CIA station was as infected as the Pentagon's mission, some of them felt. These diplomats and intelligence analysts wondered, what happened to the agency's elegant, light touch of old? American policy toward Pakistan remained on expansive automatic pilot. The State Department embarked on a massive building project on the Islamabad embassy grounds. The project called for every existing building to be replaced. The compound would grow from 60,000 square feet of office space to more than 600,000 square feet. Two brutalist-inspired residential towers would ensure that American personnel would never have to travel outside the walls unless they wished. The design was a metaphor for misguided policy, Dave Smith, the DIA veteran, remarked. They were building Fort Apache. When he went over the building plans, Munter cabled the office for the Undersecretary of State for Management, warning, "This is going to be a white elephant. It is going to be half empty." In reply, the office said it was expensive to change plans. He would need hard facts about the projected U.S. presence in 2016 or beyond in order to scale back. "I have no hard facts," Munter admitted. "I have only trends." They were bad, and about to get worse. The safe house from which Raymond Davis operated early in 2011 lay in Scotch Corner, an upscale Lahore neighborhood of flowering bushes and vine-draped brick-walled homes. Davis was typical of the new militarized American cadres in Pakistan. He had grown up in Big Stone Gap in rural Virginia, wrestled and played football in high school, joined the army, migrated to the Special Forces, and then retired and joined Blackwater, which sent him as a security contractor to Iraq. By the time of his Pakistan tour, Davis was 36 years old and working exclusively for the CIA. He was a barrel-chested, clean-shaven street operator whose agency contract involved setting up and providing security for career case officers when they held hostile meets with paid reporting agents in cars or cafes. He also conducted photographic surveillance of Pakistani targets and may have done the odd black bag job, judging by the gear he carried. Since Mumbai, the CIA base in Lahore had been assigned to watch and document Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Kashmir militants whose cadres had carried out that mass murder. CIA contractors photographed and helped NSA colleagues eavesdrop on the homes of ISI and Pakistan Army officers who met with Lashkar leaders. On Thursday, January 27, 2011, at midday, Raymond Davis drove out from Scotch Corner by himself, steering through Lahore's smoky traffic in an unmarked Honda VTI. He had a digital camera, a Motorola radio linked to the CIA base in Lahore, a GPS device, a 9mm Glock pistol, 5 magazines of ammunition, a mobile phone, a small telescope, an infrared lighting device, wire cutters, a flashlight attached to headgear, another flashlight, cigarettes, a passport, various bank documents, a little over 5,000 Pakistani rupees, and 126 U.S. dollars. He was conducting a routine surveillance check of routes to and from meeting points for reporting Pakistani agents. At a traffic light on Jail Road, a 10-lane divided expanse lined by stores and auto dealers, Davis noticed two men on a motorcycle behind him who appeared to be following him. He pulled out his pistol and set it on the passenger seat. He drove on toward Kartaba Chowk, a massive roundabout where 5 main roads converge. As he idled at a red light, the motorcycle pulled up. The passenger flashed a 30-bore pistol. Davis picked up his Glock and fired 5 times through his windshield, killing one of the two men, Mohammed Fahim, who was 19. The second man, Faizan Haider, fled on foot. Davis got out of his car, followed for about 10 yards, and shot Haider dead. Calmly, he retrieved his camera and took 5 photographs of the dead men, apparently to document that one of the victims had a gun. A crowd gathered. Davis's picture-taking inflamed them, and they began to shout. Davis radioed CIA colleagues for help but decided to drive away. He steered past the crowd. Outraged Pakistani bystanders jumped in cars and onto motorcycles to trail him. The CIA base chief in Lahore had been stationed at the American consulate since the previous summer. The consulate was on Davis Road, so named during the British colonial period. The chief knew the city well by now. He ordered 2 armed colleagues on a rescue mission. They roared down Jail Road in a Land Cruiser with tinted windows and phony license plates. Ibad-ur-Rahman, 32, steered his motorcycle in the opposite direction, toward the mall. He owned a small shop in the wealthy Gulberg area of Lahore, where he sold cosmetics, handbags, and upscale accessories. 2 of his brothers, who lived in Britain, had invested in his business. The Rahman brothers had grown up in the Punjab's precarious middle class. Their father edited an Urdu children's magazine called Uncle Moon. Ibad was to marry in a month. The driver of the CIA's Land Cruiser saw congestion where the crowd had formed a few minutes earlier around Raymond Davis and the 2 dead men, who still lay in pools of blood. The driver decided to jump the median strip and speed against traffic. As he hopped the median, he struck Ibad Rahman's motorcycle. The shopkeeper flew skyward and landed on the asphalt. He died. His bike lodged in the SUV's grill. The CIA driver backed his vehicle into a wall as he tried to discard the motorcycle. A traffic warden threatened to stop the vehicle, but one of the Americans opened the door and brandished a weapon. The CIA team fled back to the U.S. consulate without Raymond Davis. The men tossed live ammunition, a pair of gloves, and a black mask out of their vehicle. Pakistani police arrested Raymond Davis near Old Anarkali Square, about a mile and a half from where he had killed Fahim and Haider. The victims turned out to have long records of petty crime and armed robbery. Their possessions included Pakistani rupees, Japanese yen, Omani rials, 5 mobile phones, and a pistol pouch. Zulfikar Hamid, the senior superintendent of police for Lahore, took charge of the case that afternoon. He was a well-educated career police officer who spoke English fluently and enjoyed cordial relations with the American consulate. Hamid sealed off the several crime scenes, bagged physical evidence, and ordered witnesses interviewed. He was afraid that an angry mob might break into the police station where Davis was being held, so he moved the American to an unmarked safe house used by the police to store sensitive witnesses and prisoners. "Seeing the situation, I shot at them in self-defense," Davis told one of Hamid's colleagues. Davis intimated that he was afraid that ISI would frame him for unjustifiable murder. "This is not a witch hunt," Hamid assured him. "We're not after anyone. We're trying to investigate this as police professionals." Carmela Conroy, a former prosecutor from Eastern Washington State who had traded law for the Foreign Service, was the consul general in Lahore. She was an attractive, fashion-forward woman who, as part of her public diplomacy efforts, joined haute couture shows for Lahore's wealthy elite and sat for glamour spreads in the local papers. She had extensive contacts in the city. Her staff dialed police officers and politicians frantically that Thursday to try to assure that Davis was kept safe. As soon as the CIA team that had run over Rahman in the Land Cruiser returned to the consulate, Conroy huddled with the base chief to discuss what to do with them. They considered whether it was right to evacuate the two colleagues immediately. Jonathan Banks' experience was fresh in their minds. His successor as Islamabad station chief, Mark Kelton, had arrived in Islamabad only a few days earlier. He had joined the CIA in 1981 and spent a dozen years initially overseas, including in Africa. From 1999, he had worked periodically in and on Russia and had rotated to Islamabad from Moscow. That was a posting that required operating under the nose of a hostile service, where mistakes with agents or sources were matters of life and death. Kelton knew about the ongoing assessment of a house in Abbottabad, Pakistan, where it was possible that Osama bin Laden was hiding. He had to supervise that surveillance operation from Islamabad station that winter, while keeping the secret from virtually everyone else at the embassy, and also managing ISI on the assumption that its officers or leadership might be knowledgeable about bin Laden's sanctuary. "Don't give an inch," he told Munter when the news about Davis broke. "Don't tell them anything." Pakistan was a dangerous place. So far as Kelton could tell, Davis had acted properly. He was on a mission that was designed to keep American soldiers in Afghanistan safe. He deserved full support. The assessment about the matter on the 7th floor at Langley was similar. It wasn't as if Raymond Davis got drunk and killed people on a rampage. He was doing his job. He was assaulted by armed men and responded. The fatal accident caused by the rescue mission was unfortunate, but not an egregious crime. At the Lahore consulate, Conroy could not see a reason to delay evacuation. Davis had diplomatic status, as did the two men in the rescue vehicle, she firmly believed. "We don't want 3 Raymond Davises in Pakistani custody," she and the CIA agreed. They arranged for the 2 hit-and-run men to fly out of Lahore that night. They were out of the country before Pakistan's government could object. Zulfikar Hamid, the Pakistani police superintendent, went through the evidence collected from Davis's car. Hamid was a skilled detective, but it did not require the deductive powers of Sherlock Holmes to figure out that Davis was CIA. The detainee's papers included documents from a bank account in the United States that listed the agency as his employer. The 30 or so photos in his digital camera included tourist-style shots from when Davis had been stationed in Peshawar, but also surveillance-type photos of a few Pakistani military facilities, including some near Punjab's border with India, as well as private homes in Lahore. The sloppiness in tradecraft reflected how little the station worried about being held to account by ISI. In Washington, Hussein Haqqani, the Pakistani ambassador, called his contacts at the CIA to ask if Davis was one of theirs. "I want a categorical yes or no," he said. "No," his CIA contact said emphatically. A few days later, the ISI sent Haqqani a memo documenting everything the service and the police had learned about Davis, his bank information, his wife's name, much of his career history. The contractor's tradecraft was laughable, Haqqani thought. The ambassador was a political figure and author of penetrating books about the Pakistani army, who nonetheless had little power other than that derived from his close relationship with President Zardari. He was a complicated man, but cooperated with the CIA and State Department. "They don't know how to have friends," he thought, reflecting on the CIA's lie to him. "They only know how to buy out friends or bully them." At ISI headquarters, Pasha learned quickly that Davis worked for the CIA. He decided to test the quality of his relationship with Panetta by feigning ignorance. "Is he your boy? If he is, we'll help you get him out." "No," Panetta told him. "All right, then," Pasha said, fuming privately. "We will let the law take its course." That week, Panetta was reviewing the latest evidence that Osama bin Laden might be hiding near Pakistan's leading military academy. The CIA director was preparing to brief the case to a wider circle in Obama's National Security Cabinet and at the White House. If bin Laden was at the house in Abbottabad, someone in ISI had to know about it, Panetta was inclined to think. By now, the mentality that ISI was an enemy of America, despite Pakistan's status as an officially designated major non-NATO ally receiving hundreds of millions of dollars in American aid each year, was so embedded around the CIA and the Pentagon that it was a kind of reflex, a safe zone of conventional wisdom. Richard Holbrooke had hoped that 2010 might be the year the United States changed the Pakistan Army's strategic calculus toward Afghanistan. It had turned out to be the year the Obama administration changed its calculus about Pakistan. Kayani's 3.0 memo to President Obama and his generals remained unanswered. The administration just did not seem to know what to say. Admiral Mullen's staff drafted a reply and passed it to the White House, but Lute's aides thought it was too accommodating. A paralyzing debate ensued over who should author the reply letter. Kayani was the true leader of Pakistan, yet he was notionally subservient to the democratically elected president, Zardari. Would it be bad form, a violation of democracy promotion principles, for Obama to write back to Kayani directly? This went around and around. In the end, Lute supervised a drafting process led by his aide, Shamila Chaudhry. An interagency review produced an authorized, classified reply letter in late January 2011, just as the Raymond Davis mess unfolded. They debated whether to share with Kayani the CIA's analysis of which leaders of the Taliban might be most receptive to meaningful peace negotiations, but then decided not to provide that intelligence. State Department analysts proposed a reply promising deeper engagement, but those at CIA and some sections of the Pentagon wanted more threatening language about ISI's conduct. The final reply was tough. It repeated the American assessment that Pakistan had accommodated Afghan Taliban on its soil for too long, that ISI was not moving adequately. The letter posed some questions for Kayani to consider. Could he help bring Saudi Arabia into a more constructive role in persuading the Taliban to forsake war for politics? Could he help bring the Iranians into a more constructive posture? But the overall attitude from Obama down was hardening. When Cameron Munter encountered the president occasionally at the White House early that year, Obama would grab his arm and say, "We have to stay tough with these guys." On February 5th, at the Munich Security Conference, an annual Davos-like affair for defense officials, Hillary Clinton met privately with Kayani and handed him the reply to his 3.0 memo. The subject of Raymond Davis hijacked most of their discussion. "We have important issues like reconciliation with the Taliban to discuss," Clinton told Kayani. "But we can't do that while we have this distraction unresolved." A second secret meeting with Tayyip Aga was arranged for February 15th in Qatar. Chris Wood briefed the conflict resolution cell from Kabul, where he had rotated again as station chief. The agency now targeted Taliban decision-making for intelligence collection to gain insights about what the other side was thinking as negotiations unfolded. They had obtained a draft text in Pashto that apparently originated from the Quetta Shura. The text reportedly came from a leadership meeting in Karachi. The Taliban leaders agreed that Al-Qaeda was out of control and brought them trouble. The CIA collection effort also demonstrated that Tayyip Aga was not sending emails or otherwise communicating with ISI officers. Frank Ruggiero and Jeff Hayes flew to Doha with the Pentagon's Chris Colenda. Ruggiero and Hayes met Tayyip Aga at a private compound arranged by the Qatari emir. The Taliban envoy reported that Mullah Omar was aware of this meeting, unlike the one in Munich. So was Mullah Mansour. The Americans raised the possibility of including Karzai's administration in future negotiations. Tayyip Aga rejected the idea emphatically. "We will not deal with the Afghan government," he said. There was no point in even discussing it. The Americans tried to push him off this talking point over dinner, but made no progress. Ruggiero said that they needed proof of Tayyip Aga's standing to go any further. They proposed two ways that the Taliban envoy could demonstrate his authority. One was to publish an unusual statement about an international event under Mullah Omar's name that they would agree on in advance. The other was to deliver proof that Bo Bergdahl, the Taliban prisoner, was alive. If Tayyip Aga could prove that he was all right, this would further show that the Taliban controlled the Haqqanis, as Tayyip Aga claimed. Tayyip Aga said he would work on it. 3 days later, speaking at the Asia Society, Hillary Clinton went semi-public about the talks. She described the administration's strategy as including an Afghan-led political process to split the weakened Taliban off from Al-Qaeda and reconcile those who will renounce violence and accept the Afghan constitution. To the Taliban, she said, "Break ties with Al-Qaeda, renounce violence, and abide by the Afghan constitution, and you can rejoin Afghan society. Refuse, and you will continue to face the consequences of being tied to Al-Qaeda as an enemy of the international community." "The Taliban cannot wait us out," she declared. "They cannot defeat us, and they cannot escape this choice." The conflict resolution cell was prepared to deceive ISI about the Taliban talks, but the White House team concluded they could not afford to keep Hamid Karzai in the dark. They had enough problems with him. Ruggiero and Hayes flew to Kabul and briefed Karzai at the palace. Obama held another secure video call with Karzai on March 2, 2011. It was again a difficult conversation, punctuated by Karzai's complaints about civilian casualties and Obama's about the corruption at Kabul Bank. Obama said the purpose of talking to Tayyip Aga was to develop an Afghan process. "I know Tayyip Aga," Karzai said. "He is very close to Mullah Omar and Pakistan. His role shows Pakistan is serious." "Pakistan is not fully on board," Obama acknowledged. "Without Pakistan, we can't enforce this," if the negotiation got anywhere, Obama added. "Afghanistan is a client state, not a partner of the United States," Karzai complained. "We want the smallest footprint possible," Obama said. "We want you to be an ally, not a client." "Afghanistan will support you if you want us to be a partner," Karzai repeated. And yet he made clear his opposition to Petraeus's strategy. Karzai said he wanted American troops on bases not villages. That was just about the opposite of counterinsurgency. As Obama had asked before, how could the United States fight a war with such an ally? A few days later, Leon Panetta arrived at the White House with a scale model of the Abbottabad compound the CIA had been studying. He reviewed the evidence about Osama bin Laden's possible presence with Donilon, Mullen, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs James Cartwright, McDonough, and James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence. The CIA was not certain bin Laden was there, Panetta said, and yet there was a real chance they had found him. Panetta and Admiral William McRaven, the commander of Special Operations Command, had developed half a dozen options if Obama decided to act. One was a bomber strike to destroy the compound and all those inside. Another was a more limited bombing strike that might spare some civilians, but could make it difficult to know whether bin Laden had been killed. Another was a helicopter assault by special forces. There were two options that would involve cooperating with ISI and the Pakistan Army. One was a joint raid with Pakistani forces. Another was to simply tell the Pakistanis what we knew about the compound and urge them to act, as Panetta summarized it. When Panetta returned to Langley that day, Donilon called to say that Obama believes we need to move very quickly. That increased the pressure to somehow extract Raymond Davis from Pakistani custody. If the United States attacked the Abbottabad house on its own, and Davis was still in prison, he might well be killed. In late February, The Guardian disclosed that Davis was CIA, further exposing the lies Panetta and agency officials had told Pasha and Hussein Haqqani. The day-to-day diplomatic efforts to free Davis, meanwhile, as one participant remarked, suffered from the worst of the American system, CIA testosterone and State Department lawyering. Cameron Munter, the ambassador in Islamabad, was among those who thought the situation was salvageable, but only if the United States came clean with Pasha and respectfully sought his cooperation. Munter called on Kayani and Pasha in Rawalpindi. "We know who this guy is," they told him. "Why on earth would you persist in treating us as if we don't know the truth?" "Yes, of course," Munter answered, confirming Davis's role privately. "But what are we going to do?" The Obama administration held that Davis had diplomatic immunity and should be released on those grounds. The Pakistani government, not least ISI, had whipped up such a media frenzy about Raymond Davis that it was now politically implausible in Pakistan to simply release him on the terms demanded by Washington. There were potential self-inflicted problems with the American claim about Davis's immunity. Minor problems, but enough to create room for Pakistani resistance. Under the Vienna Convention, which governs immunity for diplomats, and to which both the United States and Pakistan were parties, immunity is established by a two-part test. First, the individual obtains a diplomatic visa. Davis did so. He traveled to Pakistan on a diplomatic passport. Second, notice is given by the embassy to the host government. The Americans believed adequate notice had been given, but in one updated list sent to the foreign ministry long after Davis had arrived, his name was not present. Munter described this as a bookkeeping error and sent an updated list after Davis's arrest. If Pakistan were a friendly ally, it might have been enough. It wasn't. Another problem was that when Davis was arrested, he said he was a contractor with the consulate. He should have asserted that he was a diplomat at the embassy. Consular protection is more limited than diplomatic immunity and might not protect him from a murder prosecution. In Washington, Tom Donilon summoned Hussein Haqqani, the Pakistani ambassador, to the West Wing. Donilon said that Davis's immunity was unarguable. "I'm a lawyer. I know this." "It's not documented," Haqqani answered. He wanted to help, but they would have to find some other solution than Pakistan capitulating. Haqqani felt that Donilon was trying to cajole him into backdating Davis's registration as a diplomat, if that's what was necessary. Panetta invited Haqqani to the 7th floor at old headquarters. By now, a new idea had been identified by both American and Pakistani negotiators, one that might save face. The United States could pay blood money to the families of Davis's two victims, and the families could choose to forgive him. The Rahman family would be left out of such a deal, because the United States had never acknowledged that one of its citizens was driving the vehicle that killed him. CIA lawyers had determined there was nothing illegal about the proposal, but it did smack of paying ransom to release a hostage. "Leon, you always say that you're on the side of whatever solves the problem," Haqqani said. "There's only one way to solve the problem, and that was blood money." Haqqani added that he had a bone to pick with Panetta. "You lied," he added. "If you're going to send a Jason Bourne to our country, make sure he has the skills to get out like Jason Bourne," Haqqani added. Panetta apologized for the deception but said, "If we're going to do complaints, we can do that too." Pasha remained aggrieved by what the Davis case had exposed, namely that the CIA was running extensive unilateral operations in Pakistan, belying the agency's frequent statements to Pasha's face that it considered ISI to be a friendly service. It was not easy to parse Pasha's resentments. ISI directors knew that the CIA ran unilateral operations in Pakistan and had done so for years. There was nothing new about that. ISI ran unilateral operations inside the United States, too, trying to influence American policy toward Kashmir and monitoring or harassing expatriates. Yet the scale and character of the recent CIA activity, the dozens of officers and contractors riding around with Glocks, infrared lamps, and wire cutters, was a departure. The United States would never accept such activity from a foreign intelligence service in Washington or New York. Why would it expect Pakistan to do so uncomplainingly? Given Pakistani nationalism, Cameron Munter reflected, Pasha was about as pro-American as was realistic to expect at the top of the army. If it weren't for him, Davis would never have a chance to get out of prison. And yet his CIA counterparts fumed. What a bastard. In Lahore that February, the police at first held Raymond Davis at their safe house. Conroy visited regularly, and consulate officers brought in snacks, magazines, and changes of clothes. The Pakistani police shuttled burgers from a nearby Hardee's franchise. After 14 days in police custody, however, Pakistani law required that Davis be transferred to prison. Someone in the Pakistani system decided that there was a risk that the United States would deliberately poison Davis and then blame Pakistan for the death. Davis was arraigned for trial on criminal charges of murder and was transferred to the high-security wing of teeming Khot Lakhpat prison on the outskirts of Lahore. Conroy was ordered to cease bringing Davis food. The American prisoner was restricted to lentils and other Punjabi staples, cleared as edible by his jailers. The warden arranged for his food to be tasted before it reached him to deter poisoning. As the weeks dragged on, Conroy continued to visit, but the conditions were rougher, and the prisoner's anxiety levels rose. ISI hired Raja Irshad, an Islamabad lawyer in his 60s, who kept a long dyed beard, to negotiate the blood money deal that might end the stalemate. Irshad met with more than a dozen family members related to the two robbers Davis had killed. He persuaded them, with the intimidating power of ISI behind him, to accept a pool of compensation of 200 million rupees, or about $2.3 million, to be divided equally between the two clans. Widows, mothers, brothers, and sisters would receive shares according to the precepts of Islamic inheritance law. They would all be enriched. An arm of the Pakistani government would disperse the funds. On March 16, 2011, Davis arrived in court for what he believed to be a hearing on procedural motions. Police escorted him to a courtroom cage where he was shackled. When the lawyers were settled, Irshad stood. Davis's local lawyers objected to Irshad's intervention, having no idea why the ISI lawyer was present. A prolonged cacophony in Urdu erupted. "What's all the noise and shouting about?" Davis asked. The judge carefully interrogated each of the blood money recipients to make a record of their forgiveness and to tally the amounts each would receive. The judge also required Davis to plead guilty to illegal possession of weapons, an admission that undermined his claim to diplomatic immunity. Davis pleaded guilty. The judge declared him free. An SUV, surrounded by police escorts, whisked him to the airport. He flew out of Pakistani airspace before midnight. Chapter 29. Dragon's Breath. Datakel, a town in North Waziristan, lies about 25 miles southwest of Miranshah, toward the border with Afghanistan. Near its market and bus depot is an open area suitable for an assembly. On the morning of March 17, 2011, the day after Raymond Davis flew home, about 35 Maliks, tribal leaders approved and subsidized by the government of Pakistan, had gathered for a jirga to resolve a feud over a chromite mine. Two tribes, the Manzakhel and the Madakhel, were removing chromite, but there was a question of who owned what. Khasadars, or local police, paid by the Pakistani government, were in attendance. On the other side of the world, in the CIA's Global Response Center, targeting analysts watched the meeting on video transmitted from armed drones above. The agency's unmanned air force had been unusually active over North Waziristan in recent days. On March 11th, drones struck a suspected vehicle boarded by militants, as a ledger of drone strikes kept by the local government recorded. 2 days later, a strike blew up a state car traveling across North Waziristan. On March 16th, the day ISI arranged for Davis to be released, a drone destroyed a target near Datakel, reportedly killing up to 5 people. The next morning, from the evidence available, it appears that CIA analysts watching from Langley tracked a Taliban suspect to the jirga and then decided to kill everyone present. Malik Jalal, a wealthy tribal leader in the region, was about 2 miles away from Datakel that morning, but he could see drones in the air. Watching the machines hover and unleash death suddenly was a feature of daily life in Waziristan by 2011. Being attacked by a drone is not the same as being bombed by a jet. With drones, there is typically a much longer prelude to violence. Above Miranshah and its neighboring towns, drones circled for hours or even days before striking. People looked up to watch them, hovering at about 20,000 feet, capable of unleashing fire at any moment, like dragon's breath. Predator and Reaper drones emit what, on the ground, sounds like a flat, gnawing buzz. Locals sometimes refer to a drone as a bangana, a Pashto word for wasp. Their missiles make a whoosh-like sound when released, then streak off their rails to earth to explode. That morning, Jalal watched missiles fly and heard several explosions. He drove to the site and saw many body parts scattered on the ground as ambulances rushed to and fro, tending to survivors. Angry protests erupted across Pakistan after TV networks headlined the attack and portrayed it as an atrocity against civilians. A few Taliban may have been present at the assembly, Pakistani officials told reporters, but the majority were not anti-American fighters. Kayani issued a rare public statement condemning the CIA. It is highly regrettable that a jirga of peaceful citizens, including elders of the area, was carelessly and callously targeted with complete disregard to human life. Cameron Munter, the U.S. ambassador in Islamabad, challenged Mark Kelton, his station chief. Yes, ISI whipped up anti-American feeling after drone strikes and spread false reports of civilian deaths, but this one looked indiscriminate on its face. The jirga had all the signatures of a terrorist meeting, Kelton assured him. Since 2008, the CIA had increasingly relied on pattern of life analysis to identify targets inside Pakistan. If visibly armed individuals behaved and spoke on cell phones in ways that confirmed their participation in groups carrying out terrorism or cross-border attacks against NATO, they might be struck, even if their identities as individuals were unknown. It was the timing that mattered, Munter argued. Pasha had just gone to great lengths to release Raymond Davis. Now it looked as if the CIA was humiliating the ISI director. When you kick somebody in the teeth a day after they have done something for you, you are going to pay a price. Kelton was unmoved. Davis did not enter into his calculations, he said. The United States was at war, and the enemy was on the battlefield. If you can find the enemy, you strike them. The number of drone strikes on Pakistani soil more than doubled during 2010 from the previous year, from an estimated 54 to 122, or more than two per week. To suppress the Haqqani network as U.S. forces poured into Afghanistan, the agency conducted an air war against Afghan Taliban sanctuaries in North Waziristan. This expansion beyond al-Qaeda broadened the target set. The drone program stretched Kayani's already fraying tolerance of the planned Colombia-inspired model for U.S. counterterrorism in Pakistan. During 2010, while Holbrooke had dangled the promise of a transformational strategic dialogue, Kayani was willing to tolerate the CIA's attacks on his own citizens. The general was realistic. He knew drone technology was too sensitive for the United States to transfer to Pakistan, and in any event, his country lacked the satellite networks to operate unmanned aerial vehicles. The CIA killed Haqqani and other militants who generally accommodated the Pakistani state, and therefore were not high on the general's list of internal enemies. Yet the agency also killed militants like the Massoud brothers of the Pakistani Taliban that threatened Pakistan's stability. Kayani could accept this mixed picture, or he could try to challenge the CIA and reduce its presence in Pakistan, at the risk of damaging or breaking the alliance and its financial aid flows. By the time of the strike on the Chromite Jirga, he was moving toward change. He wasn't looking to eliminate all drone strikes inside Pakistan or go to war with the CIA. Kayani did want to regain control of counterterrorism strategy from the CIA and reduce domestic resentment toward the Pakistan Army over its cooperation with America. There was hardly a member of the National Parliament, even from the secular-leaning Pakistan People's Party, who would vote publicly in favor of the current high-tempo CIA drone war. Under Kayani's theory of working from the fundamentals, above all public and political opinion, it seemed obvious that something had to give. Cameron Munter did not oppose the drone program, particularly when it targeted international al-Qaeda leaders. But by the spring of 2011, he led a faction within the Obama administration that questioned whether D'Andrea and Panetta had lost perspective. The strikes in Waziristan were too visible, too indiscriminate, and had created a dangerous political dynamic within Pakistan, Munter argued by secure video from Islamabad whenever the principals met to discuss the program. Panetta, a genial man with a sharp tongue, hammered Munter in these meetings. The CIA director argued that signature strikes had eliminated important al-Qaeda figures. Also, the agency needed to strike Taliban targets while they were inside Pakistan, because once militants crossed over into Afghanistan, they dispersed and operated more stealthily. In Waziristan, they were easier to identify. Munter countered that the CIA had moved beyond targeted counterterrorism and was now running the world's most expensive artillery system. The agency could lob missiles at Haqqani formations in Waziristan a couple of times a week, but those attacks couldn't possibly be decisive in the Afghan war. What they were guaranteed to do was to mobilize yet more Pakistani volunteers to the fight and undermine the Pakistan army in the eyes of the public. Munter felt isolated. He recognized that his arguments were dismissed by some in Washington as clientitis, too much sympathy for Pakistani viewpoints. This is a